Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of our GSC Rude Mechanicals. This is where we meet members of our artistic teams, those people who create the magic that you see on stage, our directors, our designers, our stage managers. And today we're incredibly excited to have with us Tom Littler. Director Tom, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks, Matt. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. This sun is absolutely beautiful, isn't it?
Loving the sunshine. I'm in Cambridge where I live, and the dog and I are both greatly enjoying a bit of sun.
Absolutely. Now, you first worked with us in 2014.
13.
Of course, 13. 13. It's because I've got the poster here. I'm looking at the poster of Twelfth Night, but yes,
20. There was one before.
There was, yeah. As You Like It. So 2013 was when our story began with you. But could you give us a little bit of a backstory on to before 2013, and also what you've been doing in the meantime?
Yes, I think I first saw a GSC show when I came to see my friend Tim Alsop, who I've worked with lots of times, but actually, weirdly, never with you, in Richard III, I think it would have been.
2012, winter 2012.
Yeah, which Caroline Devlin directed. I think that's the first time that I saw any of your work, but that may not be true. Perhaps I'd seen something earlier. Anyway, but I'd kept hearing about GSC from loads and loads of actors, and when actors speak very well of a company, that always makes you kind of intrigued and makes you think, oh, they must be doing something right. You know, do you know what I mean?
Yes,
you
absolutely. Kind of, yeah.
Know, rumor on the grapevine that so-and-so are very nice to work for, then you become interested. Where was I at that point in my life? I'd finished the stage of my career where I was an assistant and an associate director. I did a lot of that in the first few years of my career. And I worked on lots of, I was just incredibly lucky. I worked for some amazing, directors. I had a very long working relationship with Peter Hall, and a little bit later with Trevor Nunn, and various other really wonderful people who were my mentors, teachers.
I believe that's when Sarah first met you, our co-founder Sarah?
I think it is, actually. I think during that period we met, and that's going back quite a long way. I think that was probably 2007 or 8, or that, you know, that kind of territory. Yeah, yeah. And But I'd finished all that by the time I met you, and I'd also I'd always produced my own work as well. I ran a company that was very pretentiously called Primavera, which is a spring, which is the sort of name for a company you dream up when you're doing your first theatre production when you're 18 years old, and then it sort of hangs like a terrible millstone around your neck for the rest of time.
Is that because you didn't? I mean, it's funny you say that, because when Sarah and I were creating GSC 14 years ago, we were trying to decide what to call GSC.
Yeah.
Back then, and I had this idea. I had two awful ideas, and thank goodness Sarah said no, because one was called the Snooty Camel Theatre Company.
Well, thank God.
And one was called, really pretentiously, the Independent Actors Collective.
I mean, either of them would have been. I mean, that's probably why Primavera never became what GSC became. I mean, thank God for Sarah.
Yeah, well, thank God. I mean, every day.
But on that score, that's extraordinary. I mean, you owe her for that. I mean, yes, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I was just on a plane home from our holiday or something. I thought, oh, Primavera, what a nice name. And then I had to make work for this bloody name for the next 10 or 12 years or something. But we made lots of shows in kind of London fringe venues, you know, theatres above pubs and so on, and things like that. And indeed, we'd had great luck with a couple of things, and managed to transfer them in a small way to the West End and stuff like that. So that was all happening when I met you, and I was just kind of starting to get quite a lot of work at I suppose theatre companies a little bit like GSC, independent regional theatres and so on. I think I might have done my first, yes, I'd done my first couple of jobs abroad by that point. I'd worked in Hungary, I think, and maybe in Austria. So it was an exciting time, 2013. It seems a very long time ago now, and I feel like I've lived two or three lives since then. But it was a good time. It felt like, when you're a director, your career goes in weird. It's like you have these periods of building. Like when you first start assisting, that's terribly exciting because everything you're doing, you're learning, and you just keep getting better. Or you think you are, or you're learning new skills and you're meeting new people, and that's all very exciting. And people start saying, oh, you're ready to move on to the next level. And then absolutely nothing happens for years. And then just one or two things begin to happen again. And I think 2013 was a very happy time for me because I'd had about 3 or 4 years of sort of plateau. Just kind of waiting for people to start ringing me, really, and asking me to direct work for them, rather than me having to kind of barge my way in, help those out. and I had a kind of, for a few years, it looked as if I was going to be a very commercial director. I'd done a lot of work assisting in the West End and on kind of commercial tours, things like that, and I had quite a lot of production that were pitched at a very high level for kind of lovely long commercial tours that were going to come to the West End and things like that.
Yeah,
and absolutely none of them had happened. thing after thing after thing after thing had come to nothing, and I think I'd done one lovely long tour for Theatre Royal Bath with Penelope Keith in it. I directed that, and that had been gorgeous. But mostly, apart from remounting other people's shows, all these long conversations had come
to nothing.
To nothing.
Yeah.
Which is quite common in directors' lives. I mean, the bit of the career that you can see is like this tiny top bit of the iceberg, and then underneath there's this huge submerged thing of all the conversations you have about projects that don't happen. So 2013 was fun because just there were things that were actually starting to happen and people phoning me.
Lovely. Obviously, we've worked together, a lot on a number of shows and things, but I thought it'd be interesting to ask you as a director, and everybody is different, all actors are different, designers are different, and so on, about how you begin work on a project. What's your approach? Do you have any things that are, you always do the same thing, or every project is different, or I'm sure there's a huge gamut of stuff you go through in your processes, but can you give us a bit of sort of open a window into a little bit of sort of how you approach the start of a show, start of working on something?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because if it's a Shakespeare play, it's quite likely, I suppose, that that I've seen it before, maybe quite a few times. In the case of something like All's Well, which we did, when was that, last autumn?
Yeah.
I'd actually never seen it, so that was very nice. I'd only read it, but if you're directing Twelfth Night, well, I'd directed Twelfth Night before, and I'd seen it lots of times before, so that's quite hard, actually, in a way, because I find it easier to be active than passive, and I quite want to kind of jump to a conclusion and go, throw a title at me and I'll try to come up with a production for you very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Which actually just leads to really bad work. because you've just done a kind of shortcut. You've just gone, okay, Twelfth Night, funny, but autumnal, bit of melancholy, bit of romance, and First Day is going to be a northern comic with a very bleak sense of humour.
Yeah.
because I've seen it before, and so I've done a kind of amalgam of productions that I've seen. That's what I try really, really hard to have a process that resists. I think there's stuff that you're just interested in. You know, there's themes that you want to come back to, and there are things that you perceive in your own life, mm-hmm. or whatever, that you get interested in plays, and you not always consciously keep coming back to certain things. And so, you know, poor long-suffering people who see a great deal of your work begin to identify, you know, certain common strands that you haven't necessarily intended to be there or,
yeah.
But they're just particular obsessions of yours. Sometimes it's an image. All's Well, for example, built very clearly from the image of a young woman sitting on a bed with the pile of records.
Yeah.
That became the kind of defining image of that production that people who saw that will remember seeing.
Yeah.
Hannah sitting on the bed, you know, for the whole show. So the production kind of built from that, and it didn't begin with the idea that there would be two pianos. It began with that woman on the bed.
Yeah.
But I suppose there's also something in that's your reading of the, you know, your hopefully repeated reading of the script, and going, oh, hang on, this play is about grief as well, it seemed to me, which isn't something that I had sort of seen written about particularly, or I hadn't particularly heard of other productions that had massively engaged with that, although I'm sure lots have. But I just thought, oh, well, everybody talks all the time about Bertram and why he's such a terrible man, but hang on, isn't it because his dad just died? isn't that something to do with it? And so on. And come to think of it, hasn't everybody's dad just died in this play?
Yeah, and it's a lot more. And I think when you start to look at that, I know from I've been in the rehearsal room, it's a lot more than just what you think the play is about, that theme, which everybody seems to know the play to be about that theme. But actually, you've got a whole, you know, company of characters there who are bringing in real life elements of their own lives to it. And suddenly it's not just about, you know, what you say about this young man who's really vile to a girl who seems to follow him all across Europe. There's so many more underlying things that are going on in there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things let's just keep talking about Shakespeare, because in a way, otherwise the conversation is so huge, isn't it?
But
Shakespeare is so the plays are so plural and so generous, you know, in such a way that you could take them in so many different ways.
Yeah.
You know, what on earth is King Lear or All's Well or Twelfth Night about? Or, you know, what do you want each thing? And you actually have to make choices. You know, you can't just you know, even if you're not doing this absolutely consciously, I think you will always in a way be a lens through which the play is going to get filtered. So my Twelfth Night will automatically be different from your Twelfth Night, even if we're not particularly setting out to make choices, just because we've lived different lives and we have different personalities and so on. But you have to get quite tough, I think, with those plays. You have to really boss them around, because otherwise they're so infinitely generous, you could end up making a production that doesn't really do anything at all and is sort of about nothing and, you know, just has, you know, and now here's a funny scene and now here's a serious scene, this bit's romantic and this bit they get cross and have a fight. And I don't mean that that's a fault in the writing, I just mean that if you don't guide everybody involved in the production, designers, stage management, the people who find the props, of course the actors, the people who compose the music and everything, you know, if you don't guide it quite firmly, it can be quite a meh, I think. There has to be a coherent world.
Yeah.
Somehow, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I think, you know, like, you're, you know, again, because not only is it you, the director and the play, sit there, you have your ideas, that's, you know, one, you know, great, that's where my thought is, but you're then about to open this out to producers, designers, as you say, stage managers, prop buyers, fight directors, and then the cast, who will all have their own version of what they think Barone is, or what Armado is, or what Costard is, and so on. Yeah. And so it is important for you, the director, I'm assuming, therefore, to go, to hang on to your original idea of where you're going to go with this, so that you can, I don't say marshal, but that sort of filter everybody towards this end point that you're aiming for, which is a huge kind of plate spinning task in itself, isn't it?
Yes, it's really interesting that, isn't it? Because you do want to do exactly that. You know, I mean, you've just referenced lots of lovely characters from Love's Labour's Lost, which we did together in 2018. And there's a photo of it on my wall.
Aww. Right there.
I can see Natasha Rickman and Gavin Parlour at a rather sad moment of the play. You do have to say, that is a lovely idea, it doesn't belong in this production, you know, and thank you for that lovely idea, and that one doesn't belong in this production either. That idea C, does belong in this production. So yes, you do have to do that kind of task, which is, I suppose, editorial in a way.
Yeah.
But you also, you can't shut down the creativity in the room, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got to prepare somehow in such a way that that you know the material inside out, back to front, and that you have a very clear sense of, well, I would say for me, a very clear sense of the questions I want to ask, not necessarily a very clear sense of what the answers might be, you know. So, you know, one of the things that drew me to Love's Labour's Lost was that extraordinary final act, which I'm sure you remember, and that final act, which is nearly as long as, it's like, what is it, like 45 minute act five or something. And that sort of, you know, it's this comedy and it's building to a comic climax, and then whatever it is, 25 minutes, 20 minutes from the end, this extraordinary thing happens, that this messenger called Mark a Day comes into the middle of the, Mark a Day, I'm sure that's a pun, comes into the middle of this party and says, "I'm so sorry, Princess of France, but your father's just died." And these lives that have been building to this extraordinary, wonderful romantic comedy ending are shattered, actually. And then you've got, you know, 20, 25 minutes of kind of unravelling from that point. Perhaps I'm getting the times wrong. Maybe it's a bit less long after that. But anyway, you know the thing.
Yeah.
So if you know that you're interested in exploring what that shape is, or if you know that you're interested in, you know, how people could build themselves up into a kind of souffle or balloon, and then just one little tiny thing could send their lives into freefall. Then there's your question, I suppose. And you might then have to rule out some other questions. I would really hate to know the answers, though, before you start. I think that could be very dangerous.
Because it keeps it a collaborative experience, I assume, you know, from your point of view. Well, I know from my point of view as an actor in the room, it always feels a collaborative experience with you and the other directors that we work with, that there's you're creating together. The director and the designer have come together with a framework of this is...
Yeah.
our idea, and this is what the set might look like, and so on.
Yeah.
But then I always get the feeling as an actor that you can bring your ideas, your thoughts about your character, the situations, the scenario, and you build it together, because then someone else who you're going to have the scene with has got something else, and they've got something else, and it slowly starts to. It's like an alchemy, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's and I mean, a huge amount of directing is about enabling other people to do their best work. I mean, that's a truism, I suppose. You know, we all know that directing is not, you know, some kind of Napoleon figure standing in the middle saying, move 3 paces to the right, and, you know, you know, that actually our jobs are in many ways to encourage people to be as creative as possible, and then to go, that idea, that is dreamy, now add 10% of this to it, you know? But not to say, here is the idea of what you will do now, you know, because that just leads to kind of horrible work. But you sort of also have to kind of hold this this place or space of uncertainty, you know, of confident uncertainty and confident unknowing.
Yeah.
You know, that you can be in the middle of rehearsing a scene and you really have to sometimes just refuse to provide the answer. And people often say, oh, that's because you know the answer and you're waiting for the actors to get to it. Well, that's a very flattering view, but it's because you don't know the answer either.
Yeah.
And you just have to trust yourself and the people in the room.
Moving on a bit into sort of we've mentioned a lot of the GSC stuff that we've done. Now, obviously, very different to a lot of the other stuff that you've done as well. We are not in a theatre. So how has, and I know that there is a, you have a particular angle on working with us in terms of finding sites. There's got to be a reason why we're in the open air for this play. The whole play takes place in a drawing room. So why are we in a cast? Why are we in some gardens?
I'm obsessed with it. Yeah. But I find it very, easy actually to think about the open air and the kind of site-specific work that we've done. Because, well, there's your first set of parameters, really, aren't they? You know, I mean, She Stoops to Conquer, which we're hopefully about to do this summer. Let's see, we'll find out. You know, if you begin from the kind of working assumption that, okay, She Stoops to Conquer is set in an 18th century house that looks like an inn, but you, for better or worse, have asked me to do it outdoors in a park. Well, there's no point, it seems to me, building, you know, a whole set to sit underneath the sky where we all pretend that there's a ceiling. I mean, there isn't, you know, sky, you can hear the birds.
Yeah.
So the very first provocation then for that production becomes, why are they outside?
Yeah.
You know, that's your first question. And you begin by trying to think about, okay, why mm-hmm. might these scenes that are supposed to be inside be outside? What might that lead on to? You know, these two young men arrive in the middle of the countryside. Why might they have arrived here? You know, so I find those restrictions enormously creative. I mean, the other wonderful thing about outdoors, you know, thinking about something like Love's Labours or Much Ado or As You Like It, which were all in the Law College with that huge, I mean, I think we have the audience basically in the same place for all three of those productions, looking up that wonderful bank with the cascade of steps coming down the gate at the very, very top. And then we used the staging differently within it, but basically that same kind of aspect.
Vista,
There's something about that which is a huge gift, which you could never have in a theatre, which is that it's enormous. It is absolutely vast. So there is no theatre, you know, not the Old Vic, where you could have an entrance from as far away as people coming down from the very top of those stairs, you know.
Yeah.
So in Love, Labour's Lost, which we structured very much as a play about a group of people who arrived and then departed, you know, that it was essentially a very sleepy little place where, you know, a handful of people lived. And then all these people came piling out of their cars, first all the women, then all the men, et cetera. And then off they all go at the end. No, the men first. And then the
it was the men first, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you want to do a drama about arrivals and departures, what better thing than this absolutely enormous flight of stairs, you know, with a gate teetering at the very, very, very top? That's a gift. One of our jobs as directors is to not quite tell, but guide the audience about where to look next.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, don't miss this detail. Now follow this detail. You know, you don't... I mean, you want everybody to be interesting all the time, but actually you don't want it to be watched entirely democratically. You want to go, watch this story, and now have a bit of this story, etc.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
in the second half, of course, you get that wonderful thing where, you know, we've got a bit of artificial light, you know, even if it's done very cheaply, we've turned a few lights on.
Festoons and, all of a sudden.
Yeah.
A lantern.
And distraction. And, well, and I have a track record of lantern. well, again, you know, but brutally, because they tell you where to look.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about lantern, you know, we all have this joke at GSC about the lantern, because it's so incredibly charming to look at lantern. But you won't look anywhere else. because someone's carrying a lantern. It's a very good way of drawing the eye, because we're just drawn to the light.
I will always make sure my next character always has a lantern, whatever the scene.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. You want a lantern, and Sarah wants a broom. We all Sarah has been asking me for years to do a scene with a broom.
We should start to draw our little chat to a conclusion, but before we go, are there any sort of, I mean, we've talked about so many lovely memories from GSC shows. Is there anything else, any other bits that sort of stick in your mind as...
I mean, some of my very, very happiest times in theatre have been working with GSC. I mean, of course it makes a difference if you have a drop of sunshine, that helps.
You know? Well, you do tend to bring the sunshine with you, so...
I know, but that's a weighty responsibility and you can't rely on it. I mean, that first As You Like It actually was a very blessed production. We all had a wonderful time on that, and it's a play that's very close to my heart, Dale. The Love's Labour's Lost was, I'm always... I do like to make a case for a play, you know, and quite a lot of people didn't really know Love's Labour's Lost or thought they knew it, didn't much care for it. And I was always a really passionate advocate for that play. And so to draw the audience into that world and realise that it really had made them laugh a lot and then moved them very deeply as it had moved me, that was very satisfying. The same with All's Well, I suppose, another play that people don't perhaps know so well, and even if they do know it, they might be a bit judgmental about it.
Yes, of course.
It was very nice to be able to take that story and bring it closer to people. But it's also, you know, the friends you make. I mean, it's a very sociable company. But GSC is unusual because their families who tend to keep in touch. So that's a great treat, actually. That's very lovely.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure and a delight, as always. And very best of luck with everything at Jermyn Street. And we will see you again soon.
Thank you. I hope to be back very soon.